This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
This is a special show on Plains FM. I'm David Hill, and recently I was at Oxford Area School with a new pilot program, Synergies in Space, which was created by the New Zealand Astrobiology Network. And the program involved the students going on mock missions to Mars with the help of two NASA scientists and a scientist from the University of Hong Kong. I took the opportunity to interview those scientists and two volunteers from the New Zealand Astrobiology Network, and those interviews follow.
I'm Haritina Mogoshanu. I'm the lead of the Synergies in Space mission. And I came up with this idea probably this year after conversations and discussions with Eric Fermat, who used to be a teacher here at the school. He wanted someone who would come and talk about Mars and the Mars missions. And a few years ago, I started doing Mars missions. I first went to the Mars Desert Research Station in Utah in 2011 with the Romanian Space Agency. So six of us went there for 2 weeks, and we lived in this place that looks like Mars. We put up spacesuits that were simulated spacesuits, but they were like as annoying as the real thing, with helmets and backpacks, and that's what I got. So this is my commander tag from the second time I went there. I went back in 2012, and we did Kiwi Mars, so this one here, Kiwi Mars, was a New Zealand crew, and we did it as a huge outreach mission. It was with schools from New Zealand. Carter Observatory back in Wellington was the mission control, so kids would come to the observatory, they would link up with us. We were there on the field, the six of us on Skype,
and they were asking us questions.
So one of the things we did was to come up with a program that would allow kids to do something that was useful for Mars training. So one of the geologists of the mission, who was the mission advisor, thought of getting them to collect stones from the backyard of their school. And we had a kit of stones that were exactly like the ones from Utah, and they were similar to the stones from Mars. So these three kind of like locations, we found stones that were similar, so kids could talk about the geology. So like, for instance, you go on a riverbed, and if you have a stone that is round, then it must be that water has been there at some point in time, so they could do comparisons. And that's called analog study, because there are very many places here on Earth that are similar to Mars, and that's planetary sciences, is how can we study space from here, from Earth. And basically that's what we're doing here.
And so you apply your field, whether it be chemistry or biology or geology, and apply that to another planet.
So you apply your field that you have here, the knowledge that you have learned in all these sciences, mathematics, all the disciplines, chemistry, biology, physics, anything, you name it, geology, geography, and everything you learned here on Earth is actually very useful in space missions. And it's the other way around. Every single thing that we create from sending people to space, because generally people complain and they say, oh, why should we send people to space? Why should our money should go to space? And it's always like, think about like this. First of all, nobody's paid in space, because nobody lives in space. All the money that they're being paid, they're coming back on banks on Earth, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And then every single thing they've done, six astronauts go to space, or they go to the International Space Station. Sometimes people say, oh, why should they go there? Maybe these money would have been better used to clean the oceans or save the dolphins or things like that. But what people don't realize is that the technology required to send these six people to the International Space Station that would be living there in space, that they might not find that it's logical. Actually, all this technology is coming back to Earth in technology that is saving lives. So mobile phones, there are air filters that have been invented because people had to have better air filters on the space station. There are creams for face, you know, you can put them on and you can look younger. These are for astronauts. Osteoporosis is being studied.
That's the result of it.
So all these, and these are called space spin-offs. And all these space spin-offs are coming from sending people to space. So this is really important for me. I always like to point out how much we actually gained from sending people there, even though it's not a direct return, but it's an indirect. And mobile phones. And
so it's pushing humanity to ever further limits.
Further limits. And a lot of these devices are devices that save life, you know, like the press the button and the ambulance is coming, or radio communications and things like that, that didn't exist and would not have existed if we didn't get to space.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess part of it here is that these young people could be part of discovering life in the future, couldn't they?
I hope so. Yeah. And we couldn't take everybody here in the school to the Mars Desert Research Station, although we wish to because it's such an amazing place. But what we thought of doing was to bring a little bit of that Mars environment to them. And so that's how we came up with this idea. And it takes a team to do everything. So I have the most amazing team here that is working to make this possible. And people have been putting a lot of long hours to this mission to do the planning. We've never done this before, so this is the first time. It's a pilot. If this goes well, we want to deploy it at schools in New Zealand for 1 week. We can come to you and do a Mars week.
Yeah, so this is something you're going to take.
This is something we're going to take, and take it further. And if schools would like to learn about Mars, we could come to them and do this 1 week Mars mission where kids would be immersed in studying Mars and planetary sciences in general. But most important is that they're going to learn how to work in a team, and we use space as a hook because it's cool.
Yeah.
But it's actually about them working in a team and working together and collaborating and understanding that nothing is done in seclusion and everything is done in a team and in working together. That's the key to success. Yeah.
But I guess at the same time, the space industry in New Zealand is growing, isn't it?
Yeah.
There are opportunities that perhaps there weren't 10 or 20 years ago, isn't there?
Yeah, space industry in New Zealand is growing. We are now launching rockets, and it's just brings everything to reality. Like before, when we didn't have rockets that went to space and other countries would be doing, people would say, oh, why should we train for space, or why should I let my children be space scientists because we don't have anything that goes into space? Well, now we do, and we don't know how this will evolve. How?
And of course, there's a whole tourist industry around places like Tekapo, isn't there?
Yeah.
As well, and there's also a lot of research coming out of the universities in New Zealand too that to do with space too, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah, and kids can go and apply for scholarships. They can go to NASA. They can go to the European Space Agency and study. Anything is possible. So I think that's the message that we want to send to these kids by doing these missions, that you can broaden your horizons, and thinking out of the box is the new norm, and you can do anything you want in life. Just ask for it.
Exactly, yeah. Oh, that's great.
Cool.
Hi, I'm Sam Leskey. The exercise that the students are working on is a simulated Mars mission. So we've got five groups of astronauts. There's five astronauts in each group. They've gone to Mars. Now, Mars today is the school field. We've broken into five areas. They're doing five missions, two geology missions, two engineering missions, and a mapping mission. Now, the teams that we've got in this area here, they're mission control. So we've got five areas of mission control. They've only got radio communications with their astronauts. The astronauts have each got a radio, but there's only one radio for mission control. So they have to be very careful about how they're talking, what they talk about.
Yep.
They've got to use a lot of radio discipline. And we've spent a bit of time working with them and teaching them those sort of skills. They've spent an hour of mission planning. So they've looked at all the different roles that they have to do. Every single one of them's got a particular purpose and a particular role that they've got to look at and do.
Yep.
It could be communications logging. They've got an engineering officer. They've got a medical officer to ask the astronauts how they're feeling and what their pulse rate is. So they're logging all of these things, keeping their mission commander informed, and all of an aim of getting their mission done. So they've got each got a specific task they have to do.
So this will be exactly what will be happening when one day when NASA sends astronauts to Mars. This will be what they'll be planning and...
Totally. Probably a little more swept up with a few more screens.
But this is
the basics, yeah.
So given that 20, 30 years away, when they're growing up and...
Could be one of them.
Could be
two of them.
Exactly.
But they're learning how to work together. They're learning how to learning a bit about leadership. They're learning about coordinating a team and they're learning a lot about communications and prioritising different tasks. So there's some real core skills that they're doing as well, which are essential for any mission, really, whether it be a Mars mission or a trip to Antarctica or mountaineering. They're all the same kind of basic skills.
Because that's the thing, talking to the NASA scientists, none of them are actually astronomers, are they? They're all trained in different fields.
Oh, totally, sort of all different fields.
So they're trained in
doing
something on Earth, which you then relate to
totally,
out there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whether it be geology or...
That's dead right. So Jen and Mitch are both geologists. What they trained in. We're here as part of the New Zealand Astrobiology Network, and it's a multidisciplinary approach to space sciences.
Yep.
So that aims to join together biology, cosmology, geology, all the ologies, if you like.
So you're not necessarily astronomers. You have an interest in space.
That's dead right.
A particular field, but also have an interest in space, so you can apply your knowledge to.
And try to link them. Yep. And Mars is important because that's where we're interested in finding whether there was life or there is life there.
Yep.
And it'll probably be microbial kind of life. It's not going to be little green men wandering around. And it may well be fossilised evidence of life that's long past.
But
it could be one of these guys up there doing this, looking for this in 20 years, 30 years maybe.
Exactly, and I mean, given the vastness of space, there's no reason why there couldn't be intelligent life somewhere, isn't there?
Oh, totally, exactly.
It's just whether it's close enough that we can ever see it or communicate with it, isn't it?
And know what we're looking for, yeah.
That's the other thing, isn't it? Even life on Earth is so varied, isn't it?
Oh, totally, yeah.
And
it's surprising resilient. Well, you know, life can live in very high temperatures, under extreme pressure.
Yeah.
So, and the solar system is full of these quite extreme areas which have all of the ingredients that might have life. So it's quite exciting. And we're really on the cusp of a lot of these things. So there's a lot of missions that are planned in the next 20 to 30 years. So it'd be really cool if these kids could be involved in that. If they could, if this activity sparks a thirst or a curiosity for space sciences.
Yeah.
And who knows, these guys could be the leaders.
Eric said last month at the Mars night that the likelihood is that in the lifetime of these students, life outside of Earth is going to be discovered.
Totally, yeah. And it could happen pretty soon. You know, so it's very exciting times. It's a really exciting time for the kids these age to be involved in this.
Okay, my name is Angelica Angles. I finished my PhD less than a year ago in Mars analogs and Mars exploration. So I was working on a Mars analog in Tibet, where I was studying the different geological features and different hydrological and climatic conditions of Tibet, and then I was comparing this to Mars. So since then, after I finished my PhD, I've been working on basically the same, and I met Harry a couple of years ago in a conference, so we were thinking about doing this, and then she invited me to come here because we are all doing Mars, different aspects of Mars.
Yep.
And I'm more focused on Mars analogs, but this is great because what they are doing today, the children, is to go to the field that looks like Mars, and then they have to try to find things that they could find if they were astronauts on Mars. Yep. So this is more like a simulation, which is exactly what I do. So it's great. It's been a fantastic 3 days already, and I'm enjoying so much. This is so much fun, and I think the children are really having a lot of fun learning about Mars. And we can see that they are really learning. They know things, and they are interested. And many of them are so excited every day they come, and they are so excited for the day. So it's been a great opportunity. Yeah, and we are loving it.
And so you think that life will be found on Mars, or evidence of life will be found?
Well, I hope so. So the conditions of Mars now are a little bit extreme, but we know that about 3 billion years ago, Mars was very similar to what is Earth today. So it had an atmosphere, the conditions were a little bit warmer or better. We have plenty of evidence that there was water on Mars. We see rivers and channels of former lakes and an ocean. So, well, there was water, there was a nice atmosphere, it was a nice temperature, so all the ingredients were there, right? So, probably yes, the only thing is that we cannot find it, right? or probably with the technologies we have today, we cannot find it. So until we can send a geologist or a biologist there that can actually take a sample and analyze it in the laboratory, I think, we rely on the rovers, on orbital data, and on Mars analogs. And this is why Mars analogs are so great, because we can practice what we could do there. So.
Oh, totally, and I guess it's the message is that it's possible that life could exist beyond Earth, isn't it?
Well,
it's just a matter of whether we can find it or not, I guess, isn't it?
So if you could travel from one side to the other of the visible universe, which is what we think is there, what we can see, it would take you, I think it's 9 billion years traveling at the speed of light, I think. Yep. So if you think about those huge numbers, it's like you have to be extremely arrogant to think that we are the only ones here. So maybe intelligent life is a little bit more complicated, or maybe not. But microbial life, microscopic life, I would say absolutely yes. But we haven't found any evidence yet, so that's why we cannot confirm. But you know, here on Earth, we find life in the most extreme environments. We find life in the ice sheets in Antarctica, in the driest deserts, in all sorts of different conditions of temperature, pH, dry areas. So and then there is life. There is life that is adapted to those conditions. So why not even current life on Mars? Why not that life could be adapted to those conditions? We don't know about it, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So. I don't know. We'll see. It would be very
one day,
exciting,
I guess, isn't it?
To know that finally, we found it.
And probably in the lifetime of these students, something is going to be discovered, isn't it?
Yeah, I hope in my lifetime too.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think we're very close.
Oh, hi, I'm Jen Blank, and I'm a research scientist at NASA Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California. This is about less than, I guess, a quarter mile from Google, so it's right in the heart of Silicon Valley. And I'm an astrobiologist for NASA. I'm a NASA scientist, and I work on a few projects, one of which is the Mars Science Laboratory Science Team. So I've been working with this team for about 10 years, and since before we launched, to the time we launched in 2012, and then now we were just finished, actually 2011, excuse me, and we've just finished about 6 years on Mars. So I work on one of the science instruments associated
with the Curiosity rover.
That's the Mars Science Laboratory, right? Yep. In fact, here's my shirt to celebrate 5 years.
And people will have heard of that in New Zealand.
Oh, they will? Okay, yeah. Curiosity. Yeah. And most of our scientists are affiliated with one instrument, although we are all given access to all of the data that comes down from Curiosity. And I work on the ChemCam instrument, and this is the first interplanetary laser. So it's sort of a scout chemistry. We can fire the laser up to 7 meters away from the rover, pew pew, and then interrogate whatever we're targeting and figure out what the chemistry is. There are other instruments on Curiosity that tell us a little more about the mineralogy, maybe any organic compounds on Mars, but with ChemCam, we've actually fired that laser over 600,000 times. So this is huge.
So how does that work? Do you control it from Earth, or does it do its own thing? Or
we control it from Earth. We have little recipes essentially, which will say what we want to do. Do we want to fire one spot many times? Because by firing repeatedly, we can get through the dust that covers a lot of the Martian, almost the whole surface of Mars. So we can penetrate up to about a millimeter, and then get through the dust into the original rock. But we can also do rasters, where we can program the laser to make little patterns. So like a 3x3 or a 1x5, and that's just little tiny target spots that are less than a millimeter adjacent to one another.
So almost like playing video games, isn't it?
Space
Invaders or something.
Well, except it's very slow, and compared to Space Invaders, it's not quite as dramatic because we're firing on a rock or maybe some sand. But for us, it's thrilling because we get the data back, and then it becomes a mystery essentially to find out how the data data can tell us about the composition of the Martian surface.
So I guess there's a bit of a delay, isn't there, between communication to Mars, isn't there?
There is, and we have three satellites. Well, there are many satellites orbiting Mars, but three in particular that help us relay data from the rover back up to the satellites and then down to Earth. Yep. Curiosity does have a relay capability on itself, but it's not, it's sort of for backup purposes. The satellites are much more agile and are moving around Mars, and so better positioned to send information back to Earth. So we send data after every Martian day back to Earth, whether it's pictures that didn't fit in an earlier, or data that didn't fit in an earlier day, or actually information from that very day on Mars. So we get the data.
Same day.
Yeah, we get same day results. So
it's just a matter of hours to go between, isn't it?
Yeah, it takes a matter of minutes, actually.
A matter of minutes.
Yeah.
So is it traveling at the speed of light, is it? Or?
No, it's mostly a speed of sound.
Speed of sound.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So, radio transponder. And we, depending on... you probably know that the Earth has a pretty concentric rotational axis around the Sun,
yep.
But Mars has a very oblique axis of rotation. So there's sometimes, like next year, or I guess this is 2018, 2 years from now, Earth and Mars will be close together. And this year, actually, last month, Earth and Mars were very close together.
Yep.
But then there, in contrast, there are times when Mars is further away on that rotational path. And so then it will take twice as long for information to reach. To communicate between Earth and Mars. And we also have,
yeah.
We have an operational role, so I'm one of the people who helps plan what we're going to do on Mars for the science activities. And that means I'll be looking at images that have come down from a prior day,
yeah.
And then with a team, we'll pick targets to interrogate, or targets we want to sample, or even sometimes places where we want to drill a hole on the surface and bring that material into the rover. Those take a lot of planning, because to drill it in the 6 years we've been on Mars, we've only drilled, I think, 15 or 16 holes.
Yep.
So it's just very, very slow. And so it takes a lot of advanced planning, and we're trying to characterize the period of Mars history that covers almost a billion years of time. So we think in the earliest part of Mars history, the planet was wet and had water on the surface. In fact, we've been able to show with the Curiosity mission that part of the crater we landed in once had drinking water in it.
Oh, okay.
So that's probably the biggest discovery of the mission, which was to look at Martian habitability. So, and on the side, I also look at places on Earth that might be considered good analogs for Mars or other planets.
You spend a lot of time in caves, don't you?
Oh, just recently, I just came back from about 3 weeks in lava caves. And there I was leading a group, and we were looking at the microbial communities that live in the caves, live off the energy from the water and from the rock,
yeah.
But also leading a mission simulation where we had a NASA rover moving down into the cave and mapping and imaging with spectrometers and cameras, imaging the sides of the cave wall, looking for signs of life. Either,
okay, so the rover's going inside the cave on Mars.
Yeah, well... in California, but we think on, well, we think we've seen caves on Mars, and we have proof of that there are caves on the Moon.
Yep.
We've the Japanese Selene project has been able to identify cavities underground on the Moon.
Okay.
So we,
because there's really quite big volcanoes on Mars, isn't
yeah,
there? So there could well be lava.
Well,
we think
from orbit we've seen caves,
yep.
So we just haven't gone inside yet. And so I'm a big advocate that we should go look for caves and go inside caves, not only as a place to look for life, microbial life, but also as a place to go if we're going to colonize Mars, because it would be a safe environment that would protect us from harsh solar radiation. And also it might be easier to access the subsurface and have essentially, you wouldn't have to build new structures. You could just contain hollow spaces inside a structure that's already made.
Yeah.
So...
And I guess those are the types of places where we're likely to find life, isn't it? Because it's sterile on the surface, but in the caves or under the ice, it might be.
Well, we think if life exists on Mars today, it'll probably be in the subsurface.
Yeah.
Exactly, that's exactly right. But also, if something's in the subsurface, it's preserved in the subsurface. Rather, it might have a better chance of surviving over geologic time. So in a cave, it gives us the easiest way to access the subsurface without drilling.
Oh, exactly.
And drilling on another planet is pretty challenging.
And you've had an interest, you said you had an interest in caves in New Zealand too, haven't you?
I do. I think, the North Island is, I've tramped around a lot of the North Island, mostly for pleasure, but also interested in volcanics and seen some of the caves around Auckland. And I know there are a few caves in the South Island here. I haven't been into them. I've heard they're relatively shallow, but these are volcanic caves. I have been in limestone caves in the South Island, and again, for recreational, I've rappelled down and been in some underground rivers in New Zealand, and that was pretty awesome. But that was just on my vacation.
Yep.
So, have you done that?
Not really. No.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And of course, I've seen the glowworms. You know.
Oh but yeah. So I guess from what you're saying that your research of going into caves that will in future I guess will come into use. When these rovers are seen into the caves.
I hope so. And, you know, with the kids here are doing exercises to practice, you know, or rather to mimic some of the activities that the astronauts would do in doing, in preparing for Mars missions.
Yep.
And what the kids, one of the things the kids are learning is that it's actually hard. It's hard to communicate with a remote team and communicate effectively. And then it's hard to complete the task when they're wearing gloves, even if they're not wearing spacesuits. And so what we've been doing in the caves in Northern California is having a team on the surface directing the rover underground and learning what works and what doesn't, just really practicing to get better, to find out where the challenges and roadblocks are in getting ready for a rover mission to a Martian or another planetary cave.
Yeah. Okay. So you trial doing what you're going to do on Mars on Earth. First.
Sure. Many times. So we just finished our first season with the mission simulation in caves, and we'll do another one in a year. So we'll figure out what we did right, what we did wrong, how we could do it better.
It works. Then. Yeah. So do go in the caves and they do find things.
Yeah. Well, and also we're using one of the NASA Ames rovers that's used for mission simulations here on Earth. And obviously the planetary rover will probably be a lot different, probably be a lot more expensive.
I guess one of the risks, isn't it, that if there is life inside these caves, that there's always the risk that you could contaminate, isn't it? So I guess
that's true. We have something called, NASA has a planetary protection office, and you might think it means protect Earth from space invaders, but it's actually protecting the other planets from contamination by Earth.
Mm.
And one advantage about going back to the moon, and you perhaps heard that NASA's been directed to take people back to the moon before going to Mars now, with our current administration, is that the moon we think is a sterile environment, so it gives us opportunity to practice how to go to visit the moon and keep it clean from Earth contamination, and we think we'll be able to see if we contaminate the moon.
So you don't think there would be microbial life on the moon? Or?
We don't expect there to be, although we
know.
Yeah. And we may have contaminated the moon with the Apollo program, we don't really know, or with some of the other countries who've sent rovers, like China or the Soviet Union, who sent rovers and landers to the moon. We just don't know.
So there's three countries that have been to the moon.
Yeah. So,
and I guess there's several that have been to Mars now, isn't there?
Well, only NASA's made it there.
I was the only one that's landed so far.
Yeah, the Japanese sent a lander to a planet, one of the moons on Mars, and it didn't. It was a Japanese-Russian mission, and the Russians sent some landers to Mars that stopped functioning.
Yep.
And ESA just last year sent a test lander to Mars that unfortunately crashed. But they're planning to send a rover.
So it's got the only one with active.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
But there's satellites, isn't there?
There are. India has a satellite,
which
is fantastic, and there are three orbiters from NASA right now, and then ESA has an orbiter. So it's pretty exciting. Yeah.
There's going to be lots going to Mars.
I know it sounds like there's going to be a lot of traffic, but in reality, it's a big planet. Even though it's not as big as Earth, it's still a big planet. So if we think about
space,
it, we're just touching down a few places. There's still a lot to explore.
We're only scratching the surface, in other words.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, with Curiosity, we've only scratched the surface 5 centimeters. So the InSight mission, which is a lander, so it's like the Phoenix lander some years ago. InSight launched this May, and it's supposed to land in November. And that has a capability of drilling up to a meter down. They're going to put in a seismometer and try to sort of ascertain the structure, but more information about the structure of the Martian interior.
Yep.
And then when ExoMars lands on, it's the ESA rover, they're supposed to have a capability of drilling up to 2 meters.
Okay.
So that'll be quite exciting.
But I guess the capacity will still be limited until we get humans there, will it? Or the robots are quite effective, are they? Or?
Well, I guess our robots will get better. but another thing you realize is that when you work with robots, right now at least, things take longer, and there's something to be said for being able to touch things, you know, so bring samples back to Earth or be there in person where you can change your mind. And even though you see that rock, you want to look at that rock and that rock and that rock.
I guess if there's people there on the spot, you've got the technology and the human factor too, haven't
yeah,
you? You've got
yeah.
both instead of at the moment, you're just relying on the technology, aren't you?
Right, and being on the Curiosity team has really taught me how important it is to be able to touch things
yeah.
and smell things and walk around on things. It's fantastic to have this rover. It's gone, about 19 and a half kilometers in 6 years, so not a very fast rover. but it's great to have it. Yeah.
Talked the other night about the possibility in future that you might be able to bring rocks back.
Right. We learned so much from the lunar program when we brought back rocks from the moon. I mean, we were able to confirm a lot of things. We have better chemical information now from our onboard instruments with the rovers, but you can learn so much more by being able to handle samples in the laboratories on Earth. So right now, with Mars 2020, they don't plan to bring samples back, but they're going to cache samples. So they have a whole system for inserting samples in a stowaway tube,
yeah.
and then at the end of the mission, or at some point, they're going to drop a whole pile of these tubes. And then they'll be preserved in the state they were when they were sampled. And then the thought is they'll be retrieved at some point in the future.
Hopefully you'll get permission to bring them back.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge is there is that if we, because Mars is so vast and the missions are sort of few and expensive, if we cache a repository of samples and then decide to go back and get it, that means we're exploring the same spot. Right, so we don't have that. We commit to going to one spot more than once,
yeah.
and there are pros and cons of doing that. So, I think all of the scientists would like to touch the samples, though,
yeah, exactly.
or at least touch them with gloves.
So my name is Mitch Schulte. I am a program scientist, a planetary scientist at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. And we're here in New Zealand to help people of New Zealand understand about planetary science and what it takes to put together a mission to Mars, either for sending robots, which is what I do. I help send robots to Mars to understand the geology and climate history and all that kind of stuff of Mars, but also what it really takes to get people, hopefully, eventually to Mars. So we're here in New Zealand to talk to the school, to really help them understand planetary science, why NASA is so great, and why everybody in New Zealand should care about space.
And I guess the message is that you don't have to study anything special. You study what you're interested into, and then you can apply it, can't you?
That's right, yeah. So I'm personally a geologist, and so being a geologist helps me understand how the Earth is put together. Earth is a planet too, but what we learn here on Earth helps us understand places like Mars. And I work directly for the Mars Exploration Program at NASA headquarters. And so bringing what I do to understanding Mars is really something that's just sort of natural for me because of what I've learned and using what I've learned to apply to things like that.
So you find similar structures on Mars to Earth, isn't it? There's a lot of similarities, like you said the other night.
Yeah, that's right. So the geology of Earth and Mars are very similar. And so by studying places here on Earth that have similar kinds of features, that helps us really understand what's going on Mars.
Yeah.
We do see a lot of differences between Earth and Mars as well. And only by studying Mars itself can we really understand the peculiarities of that planet on its own.
Yeah.
But it also gives us lessons about things that we can take from Mars to understand things here on Earth. So, for example, we know that Earth and Mars have very different climate histories.
Yep.
So Mars, very early in its history, lost water at the surface because it lost a lot of its atmosphere.
Yep.
And there, we really understand the reasons for that based on geology of Earth and particularly geology of Mars.
So does it sort of give you lessons of what could go wrong on Earth? Because you mentioned that with Venus on Monday night too, didn't you?
That's right, yeah. So Venus is an example of greenhouse gases gone wild. The atmosphere on Venus is 90 atmospheres of carbon dioxide, and it's almost pure carbon dioxide atmosphere,
yep.
very, very thick. The reason that carbon dioxide is a problem is because it's very good at trapping heat. So when you build up enough carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it traps heat that it gets from the sun. And as more and more carbon dioxide builds up, you trap more and more heat. And Venus is a very good example of a planetary scale sort of natural experiment of that process happening. So when we look at Earth and the amount of carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere, we know that that's actually increasing global temperatures, and we also can take lessons from Venus that the effect is real. Yep. And that there are obviously some serious consequences on a global scale for that. The surface temperature of Venus is about 480 degrees Celsius. Yep. And there's that also means there's no liquid water at the surface of Venus.
The buildup of carbon dioxide.
Yeah, exactly. That's directly related to the amount of carbon dioxide in Venus's atmosphere.
So when people talk about climate change, that's what they're saying, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly right. Yep.
Watch those greenhouse gases.
And even on like a laboratory scale, if you took a container and you put carbon dioxide in it, you can actually watch the temperature of the interior of the container rise because it's very good at trapping the heat. Yeah. So, but that's on a small scale, right? And Venus shows us on a very large scale, just like we would see here on Earth, that these sorts of things are real and actually have serious consequences.
So is going back to Mars, is the habitat of Mars sort of similar to a desert situation in New Zealand? Very dry?
Mars is very, very dry. Again, there's no liquid water at the surface. So the temperature pressure condition at the surface of Mars right now is it's very, very cold, and there's very, very thin atmosphere. Yeah. And so that combination of factors of temperature and pressure mean that liquid water can't exist at the surface of Mars.
So it's not a desert situation like on Earth then, it's quite different.
It's quite different. Well, it's similar in the sense that there's, you know, very little water around. But in a desert on Earth, you can actually have liquid water at the surface. On Mars, you just can't have liquid water.
Because of the difference in the atmosphere?
It's because of the difference in temperature pressure conditions, so that combination. So water at the surface of Mars. Water does exist on Mars. Yeah. But it's at the surface, it's either in the form of water vapor in the atmosphere or as ice.
So that sort of scenario of the sterilization on Mars, could that happen on Earth?
It's possible. It would probably really take a lot to get Earth to be in a dire straits like that. But again, we do take lessons from Mars, and we've actually been studying Mars. We have a spacecraft in orbit around Mars right now that's looking at the rate of escape of gas from the atmosphere. And we think that part of that, that's partly what's responsible for the fact that Mars dried out fairly early in its history. Okay. So there was a transition period about 3.5 billion years ago when Mars went from probably being fairly warm and fairly wet, because we see evidence of river channels and lake deposits and all that kind of stuff in really old rocks on Mars.
So that's another example of sort of climate change over a long period of time.
Exactly, yeah. Very different scenario in that case.
To Venus, yep.
Yeah, the atmosphere of Mars has been stripped away by the solar wind.
Okay.
And so and because Mars is smaller than the Earth, it's not able to hold the atmosphere very well.
Okay.
It's been stripping it out. Yeah. Yeah. So the solar wind sort of knocks the atmosphere off of the surface or near the surface of Mars.
So where do you think life will be on Mars if it's there?
What we're doing at NASA is looking for evidence in the rocks that life existed in the past.
Okay.
Again, because the surface is probably fairly inhospitable to life because of the liquid water problem. I should also clarify that there is some evidence that there may be tiny amounts of liquid water near the surface of Mars. If that were the case, though, it would have to be very, very salty water. So in the wintertime, when you put salt out to melt the ice on the ground to clear up your driveway or whatever, we think a similar kind of thing can be happening, because dissolving salts into water actually depresses the freezing point.
Okay.
And so if you have enough salt in the water, you can depress the freezing point of water enough that you could still get some liquid water. But the result would be that the water would have to be so, so salty that it would probably not really be habitable.
Yeah,
not much could really live in it.
Yeah.
So just to clarify that.
There might have been life in the past on the surface, but there wouldn't be now.
Right, exactly right. Yeah, that's the point. If life could potentially possibly exist on Mars right now, but it would have to be sort of deep underground where there's enough heat and enough pressure to make liquid water.
So talking about exploring caves on Mars or something.
Yeah, so exploring caves or the volcanic regions on Mars, which of course would be a nice source of heat. So you could imagine, and we do see lots of places on Earth where there are organisms living in volcanic kinds of environments. Yeah. And so by extension, if you went deep into a volcano on Mars, there might be things living there, but that's really, really difficult to get to.
Oh, totally. And I think you the other one that's been announced recently was that big block of ice, wasn't there?
Right.
It looks like there could be a lake underneath.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a pretty deep on Mars. Again, deep enough that you have enough pressure to actually stabilize liquid water. But some data from a European Space Agency spacecraft called Mars Express. They have a ground-penetrating radar that actually the reflections in those data look like it's a layer of liquid water. But again, it's pretty deep.
So how hard would it be to find out what's under that?
Well, I mean, the only direct way to check is to drill into it. But again,
you've got to get the equipment to Mars.
Yeah. So far, we've only been able to drill a few centimeters on the surface of Mars, and so having a drill rig that could go deeper is pretty tough.
So it's not going to be on this 2020 mission.
No. What we are going to do though is collect rock samples that'll be about the size of a pencil.
Yep.
So that'll be about as deep as we can go. The European Space Agency is also planning a rover to send in 2020,
yep.
And they have a drill on the front of their rover that it will go about 2 meters. They won't be collecting samples, they'll just be analyzing them in place, but they'll be able to drill about 2 meters with their drill.
But the ice is thicker than that, is it?
It's much deeper than that, yeah.
So it'll be a long time until you get the capacity to drill through that.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And you mentioned about the moons as well. Down Jupiter and Saturn and Neptune.
That's right. Yeah. So there are some really interesting places in the elsewhere in the solar system where we think life might have originated. A couple in particular that we're very interested in are moons of Jupiter and Saturn. So Europa is one of the moons of one of the Galilean satellites around Jupiter, and it has about 100 kilometer thick liquid water ocean under the ice crust. And the reason that there's liquid water on Europa is because the gravitational pull of Jupiter as Europa goes around provides enough friction.
It's like
yeah.
I think Stephen Hawking, one DVD, talked about it being like kneading clay.
Yeah, exactly, right, yeah. Yeah, and you get a sense for that if you take a paperclip and you bend it back and forth a bunch of times and then you feel where the bend point is, it warms up. That's the same kind of thing that's happening. You get this frictional heating.
The gravity gets closer and
yeah, it gets tugged as it goes around Jupiter, right? And so it gets pulled as it goes around in orbit around Jupiter. And so that's enough.
Yep. It's a bit of energy.
Creates enough energy to create a liquid water ocean on Europa that's actually 100 kilometers thick.
And I guess that ice is enough to protect what's below.
Yeah, so the
from what's happening in space.
Yeah, so the ice shell around it is about anywhere from 5 to 20 kilometers thick, maybe thinner in certain places and thicker in certain places. But that would that certainly caps the liquid water ocean and would protect it from a lot of what's going on, because Europa is actually in a really intense radiation environment, because it happens to be where magnetic field lines that are generated by Jupiter actually get concentrated.
Yeah.
So it's the surface of Europa is bombarded with pretty intense radiation. So having something beneath all of that stuff would actually be a little bit more protected. So,
well, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then there was the Saturn moon too, wasn't it?
Yeah. So we had
two Saturn moons, wasn't there?
Well, so yeah, there are two moons of Saturn that are actually pretty interesting. One is called Titan.
Yep.
And Titan is interesting because it has a nitrogen atmosphere like Earth does, and you see you can't actually see the surface in telescopes or from orbit because a smog layer actually gets created on Titan.
Okay.
On the surface of Titan, there are lakes of liquid methane. So normally you think of methane as being a gas. It's what you use to heat your house or cook your food on your stove.
Yep.
On Titan, it's cold enough at the surface of Titan that methane actually exists as a liquid. So there are lakes of liquid methane, and there's a methane cycle. And so methane gets brought up into the atmosphere as a gas.
Yep.
It gets photolyzed by sunlight and turns into smog. And so there's a big orange haze layer in the atmosphere of Titan that's made out of hydrocarbon smog. So that's a really interesting place. The other interesting moon of Saturn is Enceladus. And we had a spacecraft at Saturn until very recently, until September of last year, the Cassini spacecraft, which was in orbit around Saturn for 15, 17 years.
They sent it to crash into Saturn, didn't they?
Yeah, and so we actually, it was running out of fuel.
Yep.
And so we didn't actually want the spacecraft to accidentally crash into either Titan or Enceladus, and so we actually directed it to dive into Saturn's atmosphere where it burned up. So that's how we ended the mission. But before the mission ended, it did a number of flybys by this moon Enceladus and found, and there are some beautiful photographs of liquid water geysers erupting from the south pole of Enceladus. So again, this shows us that there's a liquid water ocean underneath the ice layer on Enceladus.
And that's similar to some sort of thing you'd see at Antarctica, is it? Or?
It's a little bit similar. That like so in Antarctica, you have glaciers, a lot of thick layer of ice, kilometers thick, and underneath them are some lakes.
Yeah.
Yep. So it's a similar situation from that perspective. So imagine if the ice were to crack above those lakes. You would get, and there's enough pressure in the lake, it would shoot out these geysers of material to the surface. Yep. And so this is what we see happening on Enceladus.
So that's what you're sort of comparing, that's your reference point as Antarctica, and seeing, hey, that's similar. There's similarities here. There's something going on here.
Yeah, there. It's also a little bit similar to like geysers that you find in New Zealand, right? Because in that case, it's hot water that erupts because it builds up enough pressure that it shoots out of the ground. Similar kind of thing, but just much colder on Enceladus. So, but enough pressure builds up that it finds its way through the cracks and erupts into space.
And I guess, as you said the other night, that it's that anything, life might be something we don't even recognize or we've got no reference for.
Yeah, that's right. So most of what we do is look, consider the way life exists here on Earth, because that's what we're familiar with. That's what we know. And we understand it pretty well. But when we go looking in places like Titan, which has methane, liquid methane lakes on the surface, you could imagine that there could be some biochemical reactions that are happening in that, because it's a polar fluid that can carry charges and could serve as some sort of metabolism for some organisms.
Yeah.
But when we try to think about that, it's very far beyond our normal understanding of how life operates, because we're used to life in liquid water at sort of more moderate kinds of temperatures. But you could imagine that things could technically be alive in systems like that on Titan. But we really have to think about all the things that we know in terms of the chemistry and physics that make up life, and apply that to a situation like that. So it's not out of the realm of possibility, but it's something that's kind of far outside of our normal experience.
Almost science fiction, isn't it?
Yeah, in a lot of ways. That's right. Well, and a lot of science has started as science fiction. So, having cell phones and that kind of stuff started as somebody's idea that, hey, wouldn't this be a really cool thing?
I guess science fiction is really the scientists or the engineers testing out their theories, isn't it?
In a lot of ways. I mean, it's people dreaming, right? And thinking what could possibly be. So things like traveling at warp speed, like in Star Trek, is probably not possible because there are certain rules of the universe that you can't break, like traveling faster than the speed of light. But the idea that you could have something without wires that you can carry around with you that you can use to communicate across the planet is something somebody dreamed up, but there was no, at the time, there was no reason to think that that was real. And here we are, everyone having a cell phone.
Well, I think that's what Stephen Hawking said in the DVD series of his. He said that when he trained at university, it was, if you talked about life somewhat outside of Earth, you'd be considered mad.
That's right, yeah.
But now it's quite normal to...
Yeah, and again, beyond Earth, isn't it? Yeah, and so part of that is, the more that you explore things, the more you learn. As we've discovered over the past, 100 years that scientists have been looking at, microbiology and understanding how DNA works and all that kind of stuff, we have found life in so many various environments that we never thought life would have existed in before. And as an example, there are these geysers on the seafloor that are called deep sea hydrothermal vents.
Yep.
And they're not only great places for microorganisms to live, taking advantage of the volcanic gases and the temperatures that exist in these systems, but there are these huge communities of animals that are down there feeding on these microorganisms. And we did not even know that these things existed until 1977.
Incredible, isn't that? Cause
so it was, yeah.
It's the extremes, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah. It was only 40 years ago that we found these things. And now, you know, this has given rise to, okay, well, if something can live down there, then maybe it's not crazy to think that something could live at the bottom of the ocean on Europa.
Oh, exactly. And I guess further afield than that, isn't it? If planets like the one at, you know, Proxima Centauri, that's in the Goldilocks zone.
Sure, yeah.
It's perfectly plausible that there could be life,
yeah,
similar to Earth, isn't there?
And of course, we've been finding thousands and thousands and thousands of exoplanets now, that planets orbiting around stars outside of our solar system, still within our galaxy, because that's as far as we can sort of get those data. But, you know, there, everywhere you look in the sky, and we've only studied a very, very small part of the sky, but already we've found thousands of planets circling other stars. And just with the sheer number of planets out there, you know, there probably could be life on some of them.
It's 100 or 200 billion stars in the galaxy, isn't
yeah. there? Yeah, yep. Exactly
so
right.
There's
yeah.
be billions of planets, isn't there?
Right, yep. So yeah, it's, you know, just you do the math and, yeah, right.
0-something% of
exactly,
possibility
yeah.
of life.
That's right, yeah.
There's still a lot of, there's potentially a lot of examples out there, isn't there?
That's
just,
right,
it's
yeah.
It's a matter of whether we can find them or not.
And it gives us hope that, you know, we're not crazy, that we're actually doing something that might pay off in the end. And, you know, again, we're learning a lot about various places. And the other thing I want to point out about that is you mentioned the term Goldilocks zone.
Yeah.
Technically, Europa is outside the Goldilocks zone.
That's right.
Right? Because it's far enough away from the sun that the surface of Europa or Jupiter wouldn't be a place where you'd want to live or could live. But if you had a particular environment that allowed you to have conditions where there's liquid water and other kinds of things that we think life needs, then, you know, we've expanded our definition of what the habitable zone is a little bit, I think.
Exactly, yeah. So are we going to find life away from Earth in our lifetime?
You know, that's a good question. We get asked that all the time. I don't want to say definitively yes, because it is a hard thing to do. We know of one example so far, and that's Earth. We are looking at Mars, again, if you want to be able to drill into Mars where you might find life that's alive right now. That's a lot of technology we have to build. That's a lot of money we would have to spend to be able to go there and do that.
Exactly.
And at the moment, it's just really not that technically feasible. So what NASA concentrates on for Mars now is looking for, again, evidence in the rock record, like we see in ancient rocks on Earth, that life left behind a footprint, as it were.
So that's what you're really looking for on Mars.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, and so we do
the habitability rather than necessarily finding life itself.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, because if you you don't find things that are living that are really really old, but we see evidence in the rocks on Earth. A great place is Western Australia, just across the Tasman Sea there, where you see evidence left behind in the rocks that life was once there. And that's what we're looking for on Mars. So we're hoping to go to a really old terrain, interrogate some rocks that might contain evidence. We call them biosignatures that life might have left behind.
That's another familiar term from science.
There you go.
Biosignature.
Yep, exactly, yep. And so for something like Europa, we actually are planning a mission to study Europa more intensely. Again, getting through 10 kilometers of ice, we're just not anywhere close to being there at the moment. But we need information, right? And so we need to study Europa more intensely. So we're planning a mission to go out there now. It's going to go into orbit around Jupiter and make 45 close flybys of Europa. Okay. So we can get a lot more information about, you know, the thickness of the ice, the nature of the ocean underneath it, and, you know, sort of study the surface and study the moon in a more intense way than we've been able to do before.
So that was my interview with Dr. Mitch Schulte, one of the scientists who was involved in the Synergies in Science program at the Oxford Area School recently. And as he said during the interview, there are plenty of lessons that we can learn from exploring space and exploring other planets. And if you want to find out more, you can find the New Zealand Astrobiology Network's Facebook page or go to the website astrobiology.nz. This is David Hill on Plains FM.